Welcome to Stack Trace, the podcast that is about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are, like always, me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
Hi, John. Doing great here. It's a cool 28 degrees outside.
Oh, don't start talking to me about temperatures in the winter. I mean, winter for me, summer for you. It just gets very depressing for me.
let me make this even worse. I have used my pool for the first time this weekend.
Great. I've used my heating system on the not maximum setting, but like medium setting for the first time this year.
Nice. And besides that, what else have you been up to?
So I'm continuing my adventures into Swift's new concurrency system, like we spoke about last episode, and we will also continue our deep dive on this episode as well, talking about actors and structured concurrency and all that good stuff. And it's interesting, I really can't emphasize enough how much more excited I am about the concurrency system now that it's backward compatible, or it's about to become backward compatible once Xcode 13.2 goes out of beta. Because, you know, with these topics, like, I was certainly aiming to cover as much about them as I could, and I was already deploying some of it in production and starting to use it here and there. But now that I can use it in more or less every client project, I mean, I eventually will be able to. I will be able to, like, use it for things like publish, like we already spoke about, and so many different things. Like, it just makes me use the concurrency system so much more, which in turn makes me discover all these topics I want to write about. And speaking of which, I actually wrote an article based on one of the discussions that we had on the last episode, where you mentioned that you at that time weren't aware that you could make a test function async, which, you know, like I mentioned on the previous episode as well, I don't think it's strange because it's kind of hard to discover, just like how throwing test methods can be hard to discover as well. But I realized that, you know, that's not obvious that you can do that. It wasn't obvious to me either. I just happened to try it and it actually worked. So I wrote an article about how to do that. And also, like, I included the Linux workaround that I also mentioned on a previous episode. And also I realized that given that there's also this continuation system in the Swift concurrency system that you can call with checked continuation or with checked throwing continuation, and then you can bridge the gap between a closure-based API or a combine-based API or delegate or whatever with the new concurrency system, I also realized that that system is a really nice alternative to the expectation system that we've been using so far when unit testing asynchronous code using XCTest, where you will create an expectation, run your asynchronous code, and then, for example, in your callback or your completion handler, you will fulfill the expectation, and then you will await the expectation just to kind of block the test execution until that asynchronous operation has finished. And I realized that you can do the same thing using these continuations where you can await a closure-based API, and I personally feel like that reads much better than expectations. And it just also makes it less error prone because you're not going to forget to like fulfill the expectation in one code path or something. And then you have a test that is just sitting there waiting until the timeout. So yeah, that's been some exploration I've been doing around concurrency this past week.
Yeah, nice. I'm glad that our conversation has led to this incredible article. I've skimmed through it and looked at the code samples. I haven't had time to fully dig into it yet, but I have it on my reading list because I do need to implement this. As we spoke about last week, I've been doing some async work on multi-peer kits, which can definitely benefit a lot from this stuff. And I had some really weird stuff in my tests in order to accommodate for the async stuff. So I do have this on my list of to-dos to fix and to adopt this. And I do agree that it reads a lot better. The expectation stuff, never been really a big fan of that. It's kind of weird and clunky to use. So I'm really glad that you came up or at least discovered this solution to make things a little bit easier to read on testing.
Yeah, I mean, expectations, they definitely are a good tool, and they were a nice solution to the problem of how do you run asynchronous code in a way where you still want to wait for the result in your test because your tests are all completely synchronous, but you don't want to block the main thread, right? You don't want to cause some kind of deadlock situation because that could also be pretty terrible in terms of your test execution.
Yeah.
But the problem with expectations was always the order of how you read the code. So first you create the expectation. Then the next thing you will read, if you just read the code from top to bottom, will be fulfilling the expectation. And then the last thing you will read will be waiting. But the thing is that those three things will happen in a different order, because first you will create the expectation, then you will start waiting for it, and then eventually you will fulfill it, right? So yeah, that's been, in general, kind of the problem with closure-based or other kinds of asynchronous code before Async Await, is that the order that you read the code, if you just read it top to bottom, is different from the execution order. And sometimes it can be kind of hard to visualize that kind of in your head when you're just reading the code. And especially with tests, I feel like, where you have things like you're mocking objects, or you know, you are creating this artificial environment in order to test this one condition. And I think just async await makes that so much simpler when you just have that line by line, like await this value, await that value. And if you can then do this for also your closure-based code, that just like gives you those benefits, even if you haven't started adopting async await in your production code yet.
Yeah, that's the big difficulty we as developers have with asynchronous code, and it's what makes asynchronous code so prone to failures and weird edge cases and bugs. It's because it kind of makes you shift the way you think about the code that you wrote. So for our non-developer listeners out there, if we still have any,
the two who are still left.
Yeah, imagine you're writing a story and you write the introduction to the story, and the next paragraph is the end of the story, and the other two paragraphs are like one paragraph where the story goes to the end, and the other is a paragraph where the story starts from the beginning again. Like, it's really difficult to wrap your head around this stuff. And even when you have a lot of experience with asynchronous programming, like most developers, after a while, they do get a lot of experience with it. It's still something that can be disorienting, depending on your state of mind. Maybe you didn't have enough coffee that day or something, and you end up being confused by asynchronous code because it's all out of order. And async await basically lets you write async code in a way that reads more like normal code, so that you can read it from top to bottom and you see things in the order that they will happen, hopefully. So that's the big deal with async await and why developers are so excited about it. I hope I did a good job of explaining it in a simple way for non-developer listeners.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, being a developer, I think so. And I also just wanted to clarify, like, those of you who are listening to the show who are not developers, like, we really appreciate you. Like, you know, we know that there are people listening to the show who are not developers who just find the stuff that we do interesting, or, you know, who want to learn more about development or hear our takes about Apple products and so on. And of course, everyone is welcome here. So we know we've been talking a lot about code lately, and that's just because, well, we've been coding a lot lately, right? And, you know, eventually we talk more about Apple products and sometimes rumors and so on. Like, we like to keep a good mix on the show, but, you know, these are going to be some code heavy episodes. And I think this one is also one of those episodes. We're going to talk a lot about code level details, which, you know, we love, and I know a lot of you listeners love as well. But, you know, we're always trying to keep the show varied and fun and not just like too technical all the time, right?
Yeah, please don't give up on us. Keep going. Feel free to skip like the code heavy parts if they don't interest you. But especially this time of year, there's usually not a lot of tech or Apple news in general for us to talk about, or at least not the type of news that we want to comment on. So we need to fill in the gaps with more coding stuff. And I'm not saying that we don't like to do that. We love doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that I would love to do is to talk more about the MacBook Pro as well, like now that I've been using it for a couple of weeks. But I was thinking that I would like to wait for you, like, until you get your computer, so that we can then do like a re-review of it, like you for the first time and me kind of like a follow-up review after I've been using it for a while.
Awesome. Yeah, let's hope that happens within this year.
Yeah, for sure. So I just wanted to go back to one thing before we move on to the next topic. And that was, I mentioned that using async await to kind of handle asynchronous code in your unit test can be a great way to use that system, even if you haven't yet adopted a new concurrency system in your production code. And I feel like this is a similar situation to when Swift itself was first introduced. And I know that a lot of teams, in order to familiarize themselves with Swift, they started writing their unit tests in Swift. Like, they couldn't yet use it for various reasons, maybe for like different policies in their team, or that they just felt like they wanted to wait a little bit until the language had matured more, or whatever reason you might have. Like, different teams make different trade-offs when it comes to being early adopters or not. And, you know, if you're working in a larger team, I completely understand that you need to be a little bit more careful around your technology decisions. And I am also sometimes extra careful around what I bring into my projects, depending on the context. Like, if I work on a client project where I have a very small amount of hours each week to work on this, I can't be too adventurous around my technology decisions because I just don't have time, right? I need to use technology that I'm very familiar with, I know works 100% of the time, and I have to make really pragmatic decisions around those time constraints. And I know that different teams are in different situations for various reasons, right? But I think what I mentioned is a good approach. Like, if you can't yet use the new concurrency system in production, a great way to just start familiarizing yourself with it might be to start using it in your unit tests. Because that way, A, you're probably going to write more unit tests, which is good. And B, you're going to familiarize yourself with it so that when you will start using it in production, you don't have to make those beginner mistakes that we all make when we learn a new technology, right? You can already figure out, like, okay, what's a good way to like structure async await code? When do I use continuations? When do I introduce something like an actor? When do I use some other metaphor? When do I create a task, etc., right? Like, you can start familiarizing yourself with that in a very nice, natural way by writing unit tests using this technology. So that would be kind of a little bit of a tip or recommendation for our developer friends or anyone who's going to write Swift code, is to explore using async await in your unit tests. It's just a way to kind of start familiarizing yourself with it.
Yeah, that sounds like a great approach. And it's kind of like using Swift UI for your internal tools, right? It's a way to sneak in the new technology into your daily work without having to go all in on it and shipping it into production.
Exactly. Cool. So that's been what I've been up to, Rambo. What have you been up to?
So I decided to switch topics this week because it's boring to hear me say that I've been writing AirBuddy Guts every week.
I was really looking forward to Bluetooth specification under the hood with Rambo.
Yeah, so let's switch gears a little bit. I got issued a Windows laptop for work.
All right. What kind of work is that, if I may ask?
Yeah. So as our listeners will know, I don't have a jobby job. So what the heck? How did I get issued a Windows laptop? So I've been doing some online course development for my brother's business. He's an electronics engineer and he sells some online courses on electronics engineering. And I basically pick up topics that he's not that into, which mainly means more high-level stuff like Raspberry Pi, Raspberry Pi Pico, ESP32, Bluetooth Low Energy stuff. Basically, stuff that's not just boards and assembly code or things like that, which is the stuff that he's really into. During the course of developing the Raspberry Pi Pico course that I've developed for his business, we noticed that a lot of students, they use Windows. Surprise. And even though I have a philosophical issue with, well, not really an issue, but I disagree with using Windows as a development platform for most things.
Ooh, hashtag hot take.
Yeah, it's fine. Like, it's your life, it's your work, you can pick whatever you want. I'm not against Windows, I don't hate Windows. I just feel like for a lot of the development work that a lot of people do, it's not like the best platform for it. And that includes something like the Raspberry Pi Pico, which is this new board from the Raspberry Pi Foundation. It uses a little microcontroller that has an ARM Cortex core, actually two ARM Cortex cores. And basically, like, they do support Windows development, but it's not like the smoothest experience, especially if you're fairly new to development on their platform. Installing the toolchain on Windows is a very lengthy process. It involves several steps and several configurations that you have to do and installing different drivers. But on Mac or Linux, you basically run a single bash script and it does everything for you. And there is like an installer for Windows that like a third party wrote that does most of this stuff, but it's not perfect. So you have to fix a bunch of stuff. So yeah, I don't feel like it's a really good development platform for a lot of like open source based stuff. I know that Microsoft has been doing some incredible work on open source. I love Visual Studio Code. It's what I use for web development and all that good stuff. But I just feel like Windows is not the best platform for some types of development. But regardless, we need to support our students. So I've been issued a Dell Inspiron 7472, I think, something like that. It's like, it's not a new device. I think it's a refurb unit. But I must say, I've been positively surprised by my experience with it so far. Of course, I haven't been using it for daily work. I'm doing the core stuff on it, but it's a pretty nice laptop. I'm positively surprised, and I haven't used Windows in several years, so coming back to it a little bit with this has been an interesting experience, and I'm impressed with how much it has evolved since when I used it the last time, which was probably like Windows XP or something.
Yeah, I do want to ask you some questions about that. But first, I kind of have to respond to your earlier statement there around Windows as a development platform. And the thing you added there towards the end where you said, like, for certain open source software, it's perhaps not the best platform. That I will agree more with. I think the way I would phrase it is, if you want to do like Unix-based development, essentially like, you know, using things like Bash and using these kind of open source tools that are, you invoke on the command line that are more kind of Unix-inspired, then using a Unix system is probably the best, which would either be Linux or the Mac. And, you know, Linux is a great system. I use it for my servers and so on. Like server-side, it's fantastic. And maybe 2022 will be the year of Linux on the desktop. Who knows? But, you know, I think for a lot of developers, a Mac is a great choice just because you have that combination of a like nice user interface with the operating system, but you also have that Unix underpinnings where you can easily just like open up a terminal and run more or less anything that you could run on Linux as well on your Mac, right?
Yeah, and to be completely clear, an M1-based Mac, an Apple Silicon Mac, is probably the worst platform for some of this microcontroller development right now, because it's so new that a lot of stuff is not really working very well. So I even have like a little post I wrote on my blog, ramble.codes, talking about how to get the ESP development environment up and running on Apple Silicon, which I had to kind of figure out myself. So I would say, unless you have an Apple Silicon Mac, then yes, for most of this microcontroller stuff, the Mac is quite good. But I would say that for most of this stuff that I'm talking about, which is this microcontroller stuff, Linux would probably be the best choice. Again, the best choice, it depends a lot on the person and stuff like that. Like, I prefer to do it on the Mac and work around all of the stuff that I have to work around. But for most situations, I think a Linux-based OS is probably the best in that case.
Yeah, of course, it depends on what you want to develop, right? Like, if you want to work with Microsoft technologies like .NET and C# and so on, then Windows is probably going to be the best.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is a fantastic development experience. And that's kind of my issue there with your original statement around Windows as a development platform was, you know, for Microsoft-based development, I think Windows is fantastic and Visual Studio is just great.
Yeah, I forgot to include a little caveat there, unless you're developing for Microsoft platforms.
Right. Makes sense then. So with that out of the way, now that we kind of agree on that, that's all good. What's it been like to use Windows then? Because I've also had an interesting experience now getting back into the Xbox as a platform, like when I bought the Xbox Series X last year, and that's been, Yeah, about 1 year, actually, since I got that machine. It was interesting for me because Microsoft and Apple, like, they have some different kind of philosophies. You can really tell when it comes to, like, how to structure a UI and, like, especially when it comes to things like settings and so on, like how to group settings and, you know, what to show where. And just by using the Xbox, which is, of course, a Microsoft platform, I found myself, like, feeling like I was always almost using, like, some alternate reality or, like, something from a different reality than what I'm used to coming from iOS or from the Mac, which, you know, kind of follow the same Apple-like UI conventions. Of course, the Xbox is a game console, so it's still slightly different, but I can imagine with Windows, you could probably have the same experience, right? Where things, like, the same controls are there around things like, you know, accessibility or brightness settings or display settings or whatever, but they're just in a different place.
Yeah, I am pretty sure that all the issues I've had using this machine so far have been due to me not knowing how to do stuff rather than anything to do with how the system operates. So I feel like it's all due to my inexperience with Windows and not like a problem with the system itself. The only thing that I found kind of funny is my laptop was updated this night, and I will talk more about the update process because there's something that Apple should learn from that. And it was on the lock screen, and it had like two separate kind of like ads for Microsoft Edge, the browser, which I found kind of funny, like, use our browser, please. But
please don't use Chrome.
Yeah, and I have not installed Chrome on this machine. I have been using Microsoft Edge, which works great. Like, it's a Chromium-based browser, right? So, yeah, it works really well, and I see no problem with it so far. But that's kind of funny. But And we've always liked to make fun of Microsoft. I think it's kind of like a meme talking about how they basically include adware with their software. But Apple has been doing more and more of that themselves. So I don't feel like that's necessarily an advantage of Apple's stuff right now. I don't know what you think about that, but like when you set up like an iOS device, Apple sticks like Apple Music, Apple One, Apple whatever plus service ads basically everywhere they can.
Yeah, I've come to realize that the closer you are to Apple's ideal customer, which is essentially a person who buys everything from Apple, the better off you are and the better user experience you have. And I think personally that's quite unfortunate because I am not the kind of person who actually just defaults to buying everything from Apple. I explore different options, and I like to use different devices from different, you know, manufacturers. And, you know, just looking at my setup right here, right now, sure, I am right now using a Mac, and, you know, I will probably continue to do so for a long time going forward. But my external display is not from Apple. My keyboard is not from Apple and so on, right? So I do like to use different kind of devices and also different services. Like, I still use Spotify as my music app. I've tried to use Apple Music because it is included with Apple One, but I just find it to be a really subpar user experience personally, like just comparing it to Spotify in terms of the speed and just reliability and search and everything. Like, I just find I like Spotify better. And of course, I might be biased because I used to work there, but, you know, that's quite a number of years ago. So, you know, but still, I prefer Spotify for my own reasons. So I do absolutely agree with you. I think only if you kind of fully embrace all of what Apple has to offer when it comes to especially the subscription services is when you will have the best user experience. Because otherwise, I've seen just screenshots and things from people, like, it will start bothering you like way too often, and you're trying to go into your settings and change something, and it's like, hey, subscribe to Apple One. You know, like, it feels a little bit too pushy. Personally, even though I don't get those notifications because I do subscribe to Apple One, because I think it's a great deal, because I get Arcade and Apple TV Plus, which I think Apple TV Plus just like such a good TV service. I absolutely love it. And, you know, so I am in that sense the ideal customer, but in other senses I'm not. So, you know, it's I feel like Apple, they could perhaps dial that back a little bit.
Yeah. And when I was setting up the system, I did like the fact that it showed me like a privacy screen with a bunch of different options that I could turn off. And that's probably because of GDPR, of course, even though I'm not in a country that's covered by GDPR, but they just do it everywhere. And of course, all of the options were on by default, but that's pretty much the same on Apple's platforms. I think like most stuff is opt-out instead of opt-in. There's some stuff that's opt-in, but most of it is opt-out. So I do like that they offered that option and then opted out of everything, of course. I did sign in with my Microsoft account, which I do have. I do have a Microsoft account, which I think I created because of Skype or something like that. So that's fine. One thing I really liked about Windows, which didn't used to be this way when I last used it. It used to be when I was a Windows user where the standard behavior was to never, absolutely never, ever update your PC because every update would break your computer. That was like the way people thought about software updates back then, which probably was probably true. Like, I guess maybe the update process was not particularly smooth, which is the way I feel about with macOS updates these days, because I've had more than one instance in the near past where my Mac was rendered unusable by a botched macOS update. So I feel like Apple has a lot of work to do on reliability with macOS updates. They're also huge most of the time for no good reason. I mean, there's probably a technical reason, but fix the technical reason. But a thing I really liked about the Windows update process was I was using the laptop yesterday. It was, I think, the afternoon. And it popped up a little thing in the taskbar, like there's an update available. Click here to schedule the update.
Ah.
So I clicked it and I told it to update at 3 a.m. because I would be asleep at 3 a.m. And guess what? This morning when I came into the office, the laptop had been updated and I didn't even see it happen. And this is absolutely not the case with macOS updates. And it's also true of iOS updates. I have my macOS devices set to like updates automatically or something. I don't know if that's the exact term. And I also have my iOS devices set to update automatically. And the idea there is that if you have your device idle and charging during the night, it's going to update during that period. But it just absolutely never happens. I have never had my Mac or any of my iOS devices update automatically, even though I have a very constant charging schedule. Every night I go to sleep, I put my iPhone in the charger and I leave it off. I don't use it for anything during the night because I'm asleep, of course. And it just never installs the software updates automatically. It has never worked for me. And Windows let me not only schedule the update, it let me pick the exact time at which it should update. And it did update. So yeah, I can say that the Windows update process is better than Apple's OS update process.
Yeah, I've also had really, really good experiences with the update process on Xbox as well. Like, it's just really automatic. Like, I never had that experience that I used to have all the time with older consoles. And even with the Nintendo Switch, I have this problem all the time where I want to play some game and immediately the console says, well, you have to update, right? On the Xbox, everything is just always up to date, which is just fantastic. So maybe they are sharing some code there. I don't know. But, you know, that's also been my experience with Microsoft's update mechanisms. I do have a thought, though, around why we both are having this experience on the Mac that it doesn't auto update, even though I do also have that setting enabled, like automatically keep my Mac up to date or whatever it's called, right? The one you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And it also isn't working for me, or rather the way it works for me is that I get a notification that says some updates couldn't be installed or something.
Exactly.
And then you have to say like, try again tonight, or which never works. So then yeah, you just update now. And I think it might be related to certain, like if you're running some background services, for example, if you have your terminal open and you're running a localhost server or something that I'm doing pretty much all the time, then I know there's this API in AppKit, or probably multiple APIs, that lets the system query apps to ask them whether or not they want to prevent a restart, because when you're restarting your computer manually, for example, iTerm, which I use for my terminal, it will pop up and it will say, hey, do you actually want to quit your sessions? And I suspect that it might be because of that, that the system doesn't feel that it can confidently just automatically restart and apply the update, because it might be that certain applications have indicated that they have some unsaved state or they want to prevent a restart. I am absolutely not sure if that's the case, but that's just like a thought that I've been having. I've been thinking about this, Rambo.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think the lower level API is in IOKit, where an app can like create an assertion saying, hey, I don't want you to turn off or sleep or update or anything like that. So that might be the case. I don't run any localhost servers constantly here. I don't think that's the case. And even then, like, maybe it should let you override that, or at least like tell you, hey, the update wasn't installed because so-and-so app didn't let me do it, because then you could like shame the anti-update apps. There are improvements to be made.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, it's great to hear that it's working so well on Windows. And I've been also curious recently to at least try Windows again, because like you, I haven't used it for many years. And, you know, like I alluded to earlier, I try to keep an open mind around these things. Like, I don't want to be one of those Apple customers who's just like, what Apple does is just the best always, and no one can ever, you know, have anything that is equivalent or better. Like, I like to try different things. And, you know, that's part of why I chose to go with the Xbox Series X for my main game console this generation rather than the PlayStation 5, because I had the PlayStation 4 Pro before, and I just figured, like, why not try something new, right? And of course, that's games, so it's not my work. It's something different. With my work, I would probably stick to the Mac, just because, you know, it would be pretty disruptive for me to change. But I would like to just try Windows and just see what it's like in 2021 or 2022 or whenever I'll get to it, because I'm sure Windows has advanced a lot, and I've been watching some videos and reviews and things like that of the latest Windows versions, and it does look really neat. Like, it looks like they are making some great progress there on the user experience. So yeah, I'd also be very curious to try it out.
Yeah, the thing I found weird is the Windows thing. Like, they keep all of the legacy stuff in there most of the time, and the compatibility story around different types of apps and processes is a little bit weird. So I'm pretty sure that this device has like a high DPI screen, and for some reason, like, just some of the apps have a blurry user interface, and that's kind of I think the only app I saw doing that on macOS was Audacity. So it's kind of weird. Like, sometimes you launch an app or an installer for something and the UI is all blurry.
Yeah, I guess it depends also on what framework they're using to build the UI. Like, I think Audacity is probably using some cross-platform open source UI library that it's not AppKit. At least it doesn't look like it. And that's fine. You know, I use Audacity for every podcast that I produce. It's a fantastic tool for audio production. But yeah, the user interface doesn't look very native, if I'm going to put it kindly.
Yeah, but like you mentioned, it is indeed a fantastic tool for like quick audio recording and simple processing. So I do enjoy it for that. I totally agree with what you mentioned about being open to other manufacturers and platforms. I feel like that can be also a great source of inspiration for developers, especially people like me who are working on products, customer-facing products and things like that. I've been trying out some Sony headsets for reasons, and I do have a lot of thoughts about them, but we'll leave that for a future episode, leaving a cliffhanger here. I also have like a Xiaomi whatever Android phone that I have here that I've been trying out. So I do like exploring this stuff, because when you get the Apple devices, people like us, like, we read the news, we watch the reviews, and we watch the Apple product videos and announcements and things like that. So we already know everything about them. So when you get a device and you don't know everything about it, it's kind of fun. Like, it's a bit of a surprise to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the times you'll get positively surprised, right? You'll be like, oh, this is super interesting, like how they solve this particular UI paradigm or problem or whatever it might be in a different way. Like, that's why I meant with, you know, it feels sometimes using another operating system feels like being in this parallel universe, you know, and it's just really interesting and fun if you're, you know, into computers and into UIs, which I know that both of us are.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. So now let's continue our deep dive into Swift's new concurrency system. But before we do that, let's take a very quick break to thank this episode's sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by our friends at Pillow, the app that can help you become more aware of your sleep patterns and ultimately help you improve your sleep quality. Go to pillow.app to learn more and to download the app for free. Using Pillow is super simple. If you have an Apple Watch, then all you have to do is to wear your Apple Watch while you sleep, and Pillow will automatically track and analyze your sleep, and it will give you a full report when you wake up in the morning. You can also get important information about things like your heart rate, you can get trends, variability, you can see any heart rate dips that might have occurred, blood oxygen levels, and more for each sleep session. You can, of course, also use Pillow with just your iPhone or iPad if you want to do that as well. Another valuable aspect of Pillow is that it can help you make informed decisions on how to improve your sleep. It comes with a dedicated section where you can discover trends, get personalized insights, sleep tips, and it can help you analyze your sleep metrics. The app also comes with an expanding collection of sleep aid sounds. You've got guided meditations, bedtime stories, and music that was produced specifically for sleeping. And last but not least, Pillow is also very privacy-minded. All of your sleep data is fully encrypted and stored on your device and in your iCloud storage account using end-to-end encryption. You don't even need to register or create an account to use Pillow. You can use it completely anonymously, and it doesn't collect or send your personal data anywhere else. Pillow is free to download from the App Store, and it comes with a great set of features that you can use for free every night. Just visit pillow.app to get started. Once again, that's pillow.app to check out Pillow. Thanks a lot to Pillow for sponsoring this episode of Stack Trace. All right, Rambo, so now let's continue our deep dive into Swift's new concurrency system. And where we left it off last week during our little cliffhanger there, we've been hanging on the cliff for a whole week waiting to talk about actors. So I wanted to ask you first around when you've been reading about actors or looking at the WWDC videos and you know, hearing about this concept, what's your initial thought around how you might use them within your code bases?
Yeah, so like I mentioned last week, it's like the part of the concurrency system that I have explored the least. I haven't written a single actor so far. But the way I see it, and this is going to be a very simple way of explaining it from my perspective, which might be wrong, so I'll let John correct me, but I see myself using actors for things like a database layer or like a data storage layer, things that are shared across multiple layers of the app and that can have concurrent access and concurrent rights, but have to guarantee that stuff is protected, basically, to avoid like race conditions and data corruption and things like that. Would that be a fair way to explain it in a simple way?
Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on there. And I think, you know, the way I'd explain it is very similar to what you just said. I would say that an actor is good for cases where you want to, A, guarantee a serial order of execution. So if you have like multiple threads, for example, querying or calling methods on the same object, and you want to ensure that it all happens in a predictable order. And secondly, you want to protect your data from data races. I would be careful to emphasize race conditions too much, because while actors can help you solve certain race conditions, which is essentially when operation A, B, and C can happen in that order, or it can happen in C, B, A, or another order, and whichever order is undefined, and the order matters, right?
Yeah.
So when we're talking about something that is completely parallelized, and you know, you can execute A, B, and C in which order you want, and you can do it all at the same time, and it doesn't matter because every one of those operations is completely self-contained, that is like typically not a problem, right? That's what concurrency is really, really good for, when you have these like isolated operations that can all perform their work, and then they can report back, and maybe you're awaiting the results of all of them, and then you continue. And we spoke about that last time, and you know, we talked about my work on collection concurrency kit, which of course makes things like that even easier. So actors can also be useful in that kind of situation, but they're not necessarily protecting you against all sorts of race conditions. What they are protecting you against is that two threads cannot at the exact same time call methods on this actor or change its state just like in a completely undefined order. The actor will ensure that everything will happen in serial order. So if three different objects try to mutate the actor's state or call a method on it, then the actor will make sure that they will all take place serially. So not at the same time, but one after the other. And that way you avoid problems where if you have something like, you know, a collection, like a dictionary or something, or an array that you're trying to like mutate from multiple threads, that can be a very common source of crashes and what we call data races, where your data mm-hmm. becomes corrupted because it's being read and written to from multiple threads. This is what actors solve.
Yeah, by the way, regardless of whether you're using the new async concurrency stuff, turn on the thread sanitizer in Xcode and use your app, because you will find data races. I have yeah. found quite a few in some of my projects. So yeah, do that. And would you say that using an actor would kind of be like when you have a data race and you basically serialize writes by using like a dispatch async to a queue with a barrier or to a serial queue?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one way to look at actors is to look at them as a class that has an internal dispatch queue, that it's a serial dispatch queue mm-hmm. that it just dispatches all of the calls onto. That is kind of actually how actors are implemented under the hood, but not exactly. So it's a simplification, but it's kind of a way to think about it. If you're an experienced iOS developer, you've been working with dispatch queues, with Grand Central Dispatch, and you know that, you know, like you mentioned, one way to avoid data races is to have, for example, if you have a database, have like a database queue, right? Mm-hmm. With a database, every time someone asks for an object or it writes to the database, it just dispatches that operation on its own internal dispatch queue. An actor just gives you that out of the box. So if you just define your type as actor database rather than class database, then you get this behavior for free.
And this would be also something that in a more traditional sense, you would use like a lock or a mutex for, right?
Yeah, exactly. It solves all of those kinds of problems where you want to ensure like a predictable order of access, or rather like you want to prevent two threads, two objects, two whatever from accessing one piece of state at the exact same time. Like that's the problem we're trying to avoid with all of these different metaphors like actors or locks or dispatch queues, right? And actors yeah. just provide you this with a language like built in into the language mechanism. And the benefit of that is that it then uses async await for that. So when you call what is called an isolated method on the actor, which essentially says that this method here can mutate the actor's state, then you call that with await. Because if someone else is busy interacting with the actor, like another thread or another object, then your code has to wait, right? It has to wait until the actor is finished and it can then process your request. So that's why you have to always call an actor when it's doing those kinds of mutations. You have to call it with await. And this is where like async await really is another huge benefit of having that built into the language, where you can just use await like you would if you're waiting on a network call or something. And then you just have that guarantee from the actor that this thing will be serialized in terms of the method call and the access.
Yeah, that makes sense. And where does the main actor thing come in?
Ooh, that's a great question. So the main actor is a new attribute that you can attach to your own classes if you want to. You can say at main actor class view model, for example. And if you go looking around in the frameworks that Apple provides, then you will also see that a lot of the built-in classes are now annotated with at main actor as well. So for example, UI view controller and UI view, they are at main actor annotated. So what does that mean? Well, it means that all of the calls that will happen on that class will be automatically dispatched on the main actor, which translates to the main queue. And the huge benefit of that is that I think every iOS developer on the planet has at some point had to use dispatchQueue.main.async in order to take some call that happens on a background thread and then update your UI in that async main thread block, because you can't update your UI on the background thread. In fact, the thread sanitizer that you mentioned earlier will give you a warning if that happens, right? It will tell you, don't do this. Don't update your UI on a background thread, because that will be undefined behavior. So the main actor then does this automatically for you. So you don't have to worry about that anymore. You can just perform your network calls. You can await them just like how you would with any kind of async await code. And then you just update your UI. You don't have to do dispatchQueue.main.async manually, with a caveat. And that's that this only works when you're using the new concurrency system.
Oh, yeah.
So if you are manually going onto a background queue using dispatchQueue.global, for example, or your own dispatch queue, or if you're calling some API that is not using the concurrency system and you're then updating your view controller or a view or anything else, then you won't get the protection from the main actor. It's only when the code is using the new concurrency system, so async await actors and so on.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I noticed that in the main actor documentation, the main actor itself is declared with an attribute at global actor. Is that something that we as developers can use as well to create like our own actor attributes?
So I'm not 100% sure if this is something that is completely public yet. I know that this was a kind of later addition to the concurrency system, and I haven't had the time yet to, you know, research if there's any use cases that I have for a custom global actor. But that will, if it's not the case already, it will definitely be the case that we will be able to do that. The thing, though, is that it's kind of like an actor singleton, right? Where it's like an actor that you can use as an attribute, and then you can use that to, like the main actor does, for example, dispatch onto a specific thread or do something else. So I will still have to research that a bit more to kind of come up with what are some good use cases for this, because so far I've just been using like the actors that you instantiate yourself and they are not singletons. But there might be some use cases for like at database actor or something, right? Like where you might want to be able to annotate something with like a custom queue or something. But I think being a fan in general of dependency injection and using instances rather than static APIs, I think I would lean more towards the instantiated actors anyway. But you know, that's not to say that the global actors are not useful. They're certainly useful for things like the main actor, and there might be certain things that we as third-party developers will use them for as well in the future as well.
Yeah, one use case I thought about is like for the new magic handoff implementation that I've been doing in AirBuddy. I have a bunch of separate controller type objects, but they all have to be synchronized to each other, basically. The reason why they all exist as separate entities is basically for code structure reasons, so that I don't have like this huge manager thing that does everything. So I separate different groups of tasks into separate controller objects. So, and they, of course, have to be synchronized. So I think maybe that could be a use case. Not saying that I'm going to do it because I still support macOS Mojave, but yeah, that would be maybe a place where you might want to explore doing something like this. And I don't think we mentioned it yet, but actors are reference types, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're like I said, they're classes with an internal dispatch queue. That's kind of how you can think about it conceptually. But yeah, absolutely, they're reference types, although they do not support subclassing because they're not classes.
So this sounds like a really good solution to some problems that we tend to have in concurrent code, but I suspect it doesn't all come for free, right? So what are the caveats?
So I would say like the two main downsides of using an actor is A, it creates a more complex call site where you now have to always call whatever you're doing with the actor that involves some kind of mutation or something, you have to call it with await. Mm-hmm. And that by itself is not bad, but it just means that you then need to be in a concurrent context. So I wouldn't introduce an actor unless I am planning to use this particular object in a concurrent environment. If you're always calling something on the main queue, like if it's super related to the UI, for example, using an actor for that, I'm not sure if that makes sense, right? Like, of course, case by case basis, but I would really discourage people from just starting to use an actor for everything, to say like classes are dead, now we should use actors. I'm sure there will be those blog posts on the internet somewhere, but you know, that's not how I would approach it, because it's not just like actors are better than classes. They just solve a different kind of problem, right?
Yeah.
And then the second thing to be careful around with actors is if you want something to execute completely concurrently, then if you have an actor somewhere that you're using, for example, to synchronize state between those operations, that is a great use case for an actor, first of all, where let's say you have 100 different operations and they all need to read and write from some specific state and they need to do so concurrently, then the actor is like great there, right? Like you introduce an actor and you don't have to worry about those data races anymore. You can just read and write as much as you want from all those different threads, and the actor will make sure that everything is done serially. Well, there's kind of the problem also, right? Like if you want to do all of those things concurrently and then you have this serial piece in the middle, your things will not really be concurrent anymore, right?
Yeah.
So my suggestion there would also be, if possible, I think I might have mentioned it on the previous episode as well, is if you're going to perform 100 different operations, if it's possible, I would recommend to perform those 100 operations, let them all return a result, and then you work on the result as a separate thing, right? So you wait for all the concurrent operations to complete, and then you handle the result as one unit, rather than having this 100 operations mutating the state in line. Of course, it's not always possible to not have that happen, and in those cases, an actor is great. It's also great for things that are inherently going to be used in a concurrent environment, like, for example, where you're storing your access token for your network calls, or databases like we talked about earlier, where you're certainly going to like be downloading things on a background queue and then you want to store that in the database. That's great to use an actor for that. But I would just encourage people to exercise a little bit of caution when it comes to either deploying actors too much or too early, where you might not need them for that complexity. And also second, like that they can become a source of just kind of data contention, where, you know, if you have all those operations, then they all need to interact with that one actor. Well, that's going to be a bottleneck if you're trying to parallelize things as much as possible.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
So just as a concrete example, when I was working on the new concurrent version of Publish, I actually originally had an actor implemented. I call it the context coordinator, Rambo. You're going to love that name. And the role of that context coordinator was to, instead of having the different operations kind of perform mutations and things and then return the results, they would just mutate that actor. They would mutate the context through that context coordinator actor. But that turned out to be much, much slower than actually just like performing the operations, returning the results, and then putting the pieces together, like I mentioned. And that's how that concurrent version of Publish is currently implemented, as it is currently on GitHub. And you know, that's just a good example, I think, of where an actor wasn't actually the right decision, because I wanted things to be as parallel as possible, and the actor kind of inherently stopped that. And that's by design from the actor's point of view, but it wasn't what I wanted in this particular implementation. So again, it depends on what you're building, but for anything where you want to both enable concurrent access and serial mutations or serial access of that particular piece of state, that's when an actor is a great choice.
Nice. So another term I've been reading a lot, and I think it appeared also in WWDC sessions, is structured concurrency. And I would like to ask you, what exactly is structured concurrency? And is that something different than, quote, the new concurrency stuff? Or is the new concurrency stuff structured concurrency?
Right. Well, great question. So with concurrency, I mean, it's kind of in the name, it's structured. And what does that mean? And what does it mean to be unstructured then, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the situation I mentioned earlier, where you have this arbitrary number of operations just executing concurrently, like 100 different operations in an array or something, that is unstructured concurrency. Because, you know, it doesn't have a structure to it, right? Like you're just performing those operations, and then for example, once they've all completed, you continue, you use something like a task group or something like this, or, you know, some other metaphor. But structured concurrency is when you're applying the same kind of structured programming that we're using in synchronous code, you're applying it to asynchronous code as well. And I think the kind of canonical example of structured concurrency is async lets, where now what we can do in Swift is instead of just saying let a value equals an expression, you can say async let equals an expression. And that expression can be asynchronous, which means that instead of awaiting the result immediately, so if you have three different operations, we call them A, B, and C again, where you say A equals await the result of A, B equals await the result of B, and so on. You can say async let A equals just the call to A, async let B, the call to B, and so on. And those are asynchronous functions. So you're not awaiting them there immediately. And that gives you the benefit of executing things concurrently in a very structured way. And that's where the name comes from. So what you can then do is when you need to use A, B, and C all together, for example, if you're forming a view model or something with A, B, and C, you can then say let view model equals await, you know, create the view model with A, B, and C. So you're delaying your await until when you actually need to consume the value rather than when you're immediately loading the value. And that, I would say, is kind of like the canonical example of structured concurrency.
I think they missed the opportunity of calling that something like lazy await or something, because that's basically what it is, right? It's basically, it's the equivalent to a lazy var, but instead of being lazy on like evaluating the synchronous code, it's lazy in terms of it won't kick off the asynchronous work until you await on it.
Actually, that's not true. So going to kick off the work immediately, and that's the benefit, because you do want to perform it in parallel concurrently. So in this case, we do want to load A, B, and C at the same time. So immediately when we call async let and we call those three different asynchronous functions, it's going to kick them off. So they're all going to start immediately. So I do get the comparison, and I think it's somewhat good way to explain it. Like it's I would just change what you said there to say that the await is what's lazy, right? So the operation itself is not lazy, but the await is lazy. In that sense, I think you're right. But the operations are kicked off immediately, and then you can then await them later. But they are all being performed in the background while you are doing other things, and that's like the benefit, right? You can do other things in a concurrent way, and then you can await the value. You can block kind of that particular block is a bad word to use in this case because you're not really blocking, but you know, you're awaiting, right? You're waiting for the result when you need it.
Cool. Yeah. The cool thing about doing these topics where one of us is not entirely familiar with it is that I can play the part of the listener who's not entirely familiar with it so that you get to explain these things. And I'm sure we left some stuff out, and I'm sure we'll get some questions. So if you have questions about Swift concurrency and structured concurrency in general, send us an Ask StackTrace question and we'll try to answer it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also one of my favorite aspects of doing this podcast with you, Rambo, is that, you know, certain things I know more about and a lot of other things you know more about, right? Like when it comes to the Bluetooth low energy stuff, as just an example, I have zero clues around how that works. And you're like super good with that. So it's nice that we have, you know, different things that we are extra good at, right?
Awesome.
Although I do also want to point out that, you know, this is a new system for me as well, right?
Yeah, like for everyone.
I have, of course, been exploring it more than you because, you know, it's a big part of my work, like really like diving deep into these things and understanding them both so I can use them in my own code, but also so I can write about them. And that is always, you know, we've talked about this before, but my process for writing is always I first use something, then I write about it. Yeah. I'm not rushing to write about things on day one. I want to fully understand it first before I write about it. So I wouldn't claim that I'm already like an expert on the concurrency system and I know everything about it, but I've certainly been using it quite a bit at this point and, you know, been really analyzing it and trying to understand it as much as I can to share with others. So it's really great to be able to do that, but I'm still very much in learning mode when it comes to these things. And I'm sure as a community, the way we use this concurrency system will just continue to evolve over the next couple of years or maybe decades even.
Yeah, I feel like library authors are probably the first ones who are going to start adopting this stuff in order to provide these new APIs. And that's what I've been looking into mostly because of some of my library work. which I don't do a lot of, but I do have some. And I must say, during our recording here, I've been opening a lot of Safari tabs on a lot of this stuff, and I now have a new Safari tab group called Structured Concurrency that I'm going to start going through because I noticed that I have quite a bit of stuff to learn about the new concurrency system. So yeah, by the way, I found that Safari tab groups are great for that stuff. So you can like open a bunch of tabs and group them in a particular topic that you can kind of go through as a to-do list in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great tip. It's also really nice. Like, I've been researching because I want to buy a new stove for my kitchen. So I've been doing some research around that. And I've also been using tab groups for that as well. Like, it's really nice when you're just comparing different products and you have reviews and everything. You can just all be there in one tab group. And then when you're done, you just close the tab group once you've bought your stove. And then, of course, you have to wait for like 6 months until all the ads on the internet will still trying to sell you a stove that you already bought 6 months ago. But yeah, that's just life on the internet, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So you mentioned there that people are more than welcome to ask us questions about concurrency or anything else. And that's certainly true because we love to get your questions. And we are answering your questions as part of our Ask Stacktrace segment, which we try to wrap up almost every episode of the show, or most of them at least, with, because we do love to get your questions. So don't be shy. If you have any question about code or anything else that you want to ask us, just tweet with the hashtag Ask Stacktrace. You can just send that tweet out anywhere you'd like, and we will see it, probably. Yes, we will. And you can also email us at stacktrace@9to5mac.com, and we will get your question that way, if you prefer email. So whichever way you prefer, we love to get your questions. And one person who has asked us a question that we would love to answer on this episode is Sorin. And Sorin says, do you use SwiftUI previews when working on a 13-inch laptop screen? And Sorin continues by saying that it's difficult to use SwiftUI previews on the M1 MacBook Air because there's just not enough screen real estate for that. So, Rambo, I thought this could be an interesting topic for us to discuss, both, you know, to answer Sorin's question here, if we use SwiftUI previews on a 13-inch screen and what we think about, you know, how to make that work with the limited screen space, but also how we work with a laptop in general when it comes to managing our screen real estate, which is, of course, much smaller than if you're using an external display. So, Rambo, what's your answer here to Sorin?
Yeah, I do have my beloved M1 MacBook Air as well, and I've been working quite a lot on it because I haven't updated my Mac Mini to Monterey just yet, mostly because I have it on Big Sur and I am developing this new version of AirBuddy, so it's good that I still have my main Mac on Big Sur so that I can make sure that stuff still works perfectly fine on Big Sur while I do changes for Monterey. So my M1 Air has been my Monterey Mac since beta 1 of macOS Monterey. And I have been working a lot with it just on my lap. Like, I sometimes go and sit on the couch to do some work, or I sit on the kitchen table upstairs just to have like a little bit of a different environment. I do like to change things sometimes. And the best thing I found in order to work with SwiftUI previews, which I don't do a lot of, but I do use them sometimes on this MacBook Air, is to first put Xcode into full screen mode. That's like the number one tip. Also hide every other sidebar. So hide like the file manager, which you can do with Command 0. And you can also hide the little inspector bar that shows to the right of the screen. I'm pretty sure that, I don't know when this happened, I think it might have been Xcode 13.1 or something, but I'm pretty sure that by default, at least, the SwiftUI preview is now shown at the bottom of the screen, so it does like a horizontal split instead of a vertical split, and I find that it works better for the small screen, or maybe it varies depending on how big the space is on the window, but like, the best tip I can give is just hide everything else from the UI and make it full screen. That's like the best tip I can give.
Yeah, that's in general one of my tips as well, is to try to hide all the panels in Xcode. And it's funny because that's actually how I use Xcode in kind of default mode. Mm-hmm. I hide all of the panels, like Command 0 for hiding the navigator, Command Shift Y for hiding the debug area with the console. So by default, when I'm looking at Xcode, I'm just looking at the text editor. And I typically don't have multiple, like mini windows or, you know, different panes open. Yep. I just have one text editor that I'm looking at. I very often work in full screen mode, especially on the laptop. I just like that for focus, like just my personal preference. And it's kind of funny because back when I used to work at an office, I've been using this setup now for many, many years. And back when I worked with other people in an office, sometimes people would ask me, like, what's that app you're using for iOS development? And I'll be like, oh, it's Xcode. Because it just looks so different when you have like a custom theme and you have like hiding all the panels. Like, that's not how most people use Xcode, I don't think, right? Yeah. But I really like that kind of minimalism of it. And I like that focus on just the code. I even have done things like you can go to the behaviors settings in Xcode and you can disable or enable certain behaviors that you want or don't want. So for example, I don't want Xcode to show the navigator with the issues tab when a new issue is generated. Oh, yeah. And that's the default behavior. So I've unchecked that. I've also unchecked that it shouldn't show the console when new output is generated, because just running an app will always generate some output, right? Mm-hmm. So then I disable that as well, because I just don't want these panels to just start appearing, especially when I'm on a laptop. But even on my, you know, 4K display, I still use the same setup. So I like things to just not appear from out of nowhere. And also, like, when you're working on a piece of code, like, very often when I work on something, like, I will use kind of build error driven development, mm-hmm. where I will change something. Let's say I'm working on a view controller and a view model, and I'm changing some API on the view model, then I know I will need to go back to the view controller to update that. I don't need Xcode to show me like the issues panel with like, this method doesn't exist anymore. Like, I know that changing this means I need to jump over to the view controller and make that change. So I feel like just by disabling those behaviors, personally, I can stay in the flow and I kind of, you know, can be in control of how the UI behaves.
Yeah, as an overall tip for Xcode users, Xcode is quite customizable, so if anything about Xcode's behavior is bothering you, there's probably a way, like, of course, unless it's like a bug, and then you can like report it or something, but if it's some behavior that you don't like, you can probably customize it. It has like the behaviors option in preferences. You can customize all of the keyboard shortcuts. I've been asked before when I told people that I hide the file navigator, but then how do you open files? You can use Command-Shift-O, which is kind of like a spotlight built into Xcode, and you can start typing like the name of a class, the name of a method, the name of a file, and it'll jump to that fairly quickly, and this has been working fairly reliably for me for the past few Xcode versions. You can totally do that. You can disable keyboard shortcuts that you don't like. Like, one thing that used to drive me nuts is that I will often accidentally invoke the fold all shortcuts for code folding, and like all of my code would disappear, and that would like drive me nuts. So I went into Xcode settings and I disabled all of the code folding related shortcuts, because I never use code folding. So yeah, there are lots and lots of things that you can customize in Xcode to make your experience better. And in terms of using SwiftUI previews in general, They can sometimes be unreliable still. They've been getting a lot better lately. But the context where I use SwiftUI previews is usually in a brand new project where I'm just prototyping making like the initial version of the UI, which is when you'll be like tweaking values and tweaking layout a lot. And that's where SwiftUI previews are really, really useful for me. But when it gets to actually trying out functionality and practice and integrating the UI into the lower level system that it's talking to, then I move it over to my main project and I no longer use the previews in there. Because when you have a large project, SwiftUI previews are really unreliable. And of course, there's a lot of work that you have to put into supporting previews in like the controller type layer of your codes, which is good practice in general to have that stuff in a way where you can inject it into your views and have like a mock version or a version that doesn't talk to the real backend, but that that's not like true of every project. So in general, when I'm using SwiftUI previews, it's in a separate project where I'm just doing the UI development side of things.
So I, in general, kind of follow the same strategy where I don't typically use previews to test like entire screens or entire flows. I just find like running the simulator is so much easier in those kinds of situations. And it actually lets you interact with your real data or at least your kind of mock server or whatever you might be using. But it's like the real interaction, right? It's not so separate. But when I really love SwiftUI previews is when I'm building individual UI components, even if it's within a project that is already like on the App Store and I'm already working on it for a while. When I'm introducing some new UI component, I typically use previews for that as well. And it also, I feel like, encourages me to separate my screens of the app and where my kind of controllers or view models or like the, where the data and the loading actually happens to the actual UI component. So I try to keep the UI components very, very simple. They just accept the data or the bindings that they need to render or communicate back to their parent view. And then I kind of then compose those views into more complex pieces, which I then run in the simulator. But I find out that encourages me to build more kind of isolated components because, to your point, previews get really, really complicated and kind of messy to maintain if your views have like 15 different dependencies, right? Then as soon as you change one of them, you have to go and update all your previews as well. And that's just like a little bit annoying. So I like to keep things very simple in that sense so I can iterate on my UI components in complete isolation with previews in that sense. And another tip I will just give here related to the 13-inch screen problem with previews is you can change the size of previews. So they don't have to be rendered at 100% size. I typically run them at 75 or 50%, depending on, you know, how big I want the text to be and things like that. And because I get rid of all the panels, like we mentioned earlier, I do have a fair amount of screen real estate to work with. And I sometimes also reduce the text size on my laptop so I can see even more of the code. Of course, I always try not to sit in front of a laptop staring into small letters for a long period of time because I'm worried about my eyesight. So I do usually prefer to work with a monitor, with a big screen, with, you know, a nice chair and good ergonomics. But, you know, on the go, when I'm just like doing some development on the couch or something, it's super nice to just have like that screen real estate available by, you know, making the text a little bit smaller, making the preview a little bit smaller, and then I can usually make it work really, really well.
Yeah, let's do a quick research here of two people. What's the font size that you use in Xcode?
It's hard for me to answer that question because I do use like command plus, command minus all the time, especially when I'm like working with other people and we're doing code sharing or I'm doing some mentorship sessions, which I do almost every single week. So then I, you know, you usually have to increase the size because I'm presenting on like a video call or something. And sometimes I make it smaller, like I mentioned, while I'm on the laptop. But I believe my default size is 18 points.
Wow. Yeah, that's larger than mine. I usually go for 14 on my big LG display that I use here. I'm not sure if I use a larger one on the MacBook Air, but I'm pretty sure it's the same because I try to keep my themes in sync. But yeah, it's interesting because I've seen people using like really tiny text in Xcode or other code editors, and I really prefer larger text sizes. That makes things more comfortable for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I also, like, maybe this is just a silly thing, but I kind of find that not only does it help me with focus, if I have larger text, it's easier to read and I get to focus on like one method at a time because that's all I can see with such a big font size. But also, like, it just kind of forces me to think more about the structure of my code again, because, you know, if I can't see like a whole, you know, 200 line class all at the same time, I kind of get encouraged a little bit to split things up more. And, you know, again, like, maybe that's not the best solution, like to have big font size, but I like it anyway. So I feel like it just gives me those benefits. But I will certainly admit 100% that is a personal preference. But I would caution people in general. I mean, I'm not a doctor, not a lawyer, not any of those things. But I do think that there's some pretty good evidence for saying that sitting like 8 hours or more per day staring at a super tiny font is maybe not the best for your eyes. But, you know, everyone, they can do whatever they want.
Yeah, so if you don't use a font size larger than 16, then John is going to sue you. No,
No.
I'll say that I have just gone into Xcode preferences and I have increased my font size to 18 points. And I will work with this font size today and I'll see how it goes. And next week, I'll let you know what happened.
All right. Looking forward to it. Yeah, it's hard to talk about these things when it comes to, like, you know, especially for developers, like editor preferences, it's so personal, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the original question here was like, you know, how to actually utilize the screen real estate on a smaller screen. And I think we gave some good tips around that. But other than that, like when you're working on a larger display or in other different contexts, I guess, like, use whatever you feel make you the most productive. Think about your eyesight. We'll just encourage our listeners to do that. But, you know, other than that, like, use whatever makes you the most productive and, yeah, be happy. But it's always great to try different things because you might be surprised. Like, when I first started using a larger text size, I thought, like, it was kind of like, why would I do this? But, yeah, it was, I find it to be very, very nice for me personally. And of course, like I mentioned, I go up and down. Sometimes I hit command minus if I want to see a little bit extra of the context. But yeah, that's my default text size, at least.
Nice.
Excellent. So please keep the questions coming. And we hope that you enjoyed this episode of Stack Trace. So all that remains is for us to thank our sponsor for this episode, Pillow, for making this episode possible. And of course, to all of you for listening to our show. And we will talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.